Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life is produced by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, a division of the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences. This season is made possible in part by a grant from the Knight Foundation and the Community Foundation of Grand Forks and East Grand Forks. Visit us online at whyradioshow.org.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. Today, we're asking our guest, Dan Gahan, why people don't believe in science. But I'd like to begin by thanking this episode's sponsors, William and Jody Haug, for their generosity and support. If you'd like to sponsor an episode, visit whyradioshow.org for details. For most of human history, people have believed that if we could only reveal the truth about things, agreement would quickly follow. This has been the case for religion, Paul on the road to Damascus, Muhammad in the cave of Hira, and Moses on Mount Sinai all believed that everyone should and would be moved by revelation. But this has also been true for what used to be called natural philosophy, what we now call science. This kind of knowledge was supposed to replace superstition with fact. It was supposed to improve everyone, regardless of who they were or what they believed. Nature, physus in Greece, as in the word physics, is the object science seeks to uncover. By discovering the principles that govern matter and energy, the laws of motion that move the stars and planets, and the innumerable forces that direct agriculture, natural scientists aim to expose the reality behind the curtain of everyday experience. This, they argued, would allow us to predict and harness nature, and to cultivate health and goodness. It would make humans a stronger, healthier, dominant, and more ethical race. If we only followed the dictates of discovery, we would finally be in control of our own destiny because we would understand how the universe actually operated. It's not a coincidence that both Buddha and Kant wanted people to reach enlightenment. Unfortunately, human history had other plans. It seems that the more we know, the more we disagree. We have a basic understanding of how nature operates. We can cure major diseases, manufacture great machines, and communicate over massive distances. We can fly and go to the moon. But for each of these achievements, doubt remains. Worldly people reject evolution. College-educated parents refuse to vaccinate their kids. Climate change deniers are too numerous to mention, and conspiracy theorists use their technological wherewithal to inspire the most irrational suspicions, from chemtrails to a fake moon landing. It's all nonsense, yet each is believed by huge swaths of the population. Science, it seems, does not stand on its own. It is not self-evident. In part, this is because facts are never distinct from interpretation. Truth only makes sense in context. There has to be background, a narrative. There has to be dots to connect. But science also lacks the very thing that religion serves up better than anything: intuitively understandable emotional appeal. Certainly, new pictures of Pluto may inspire awe for a short time, but the beauty of 2 + 2 = 4 can't hold a candle to the miracle of a resurrection. Just about everybody longs to see the dead again. Science tells them death is permanent. Religion only asks them to be patient. So science gets the raw deal, its greatest achievements given over to religious experience. A baby being born, the most natural thing there is called a miracle. And the astonishing achievement of a polio-free world is dismissed. It's hard to glory in the eradication of a disease when half the living population has no memory of its effects. We don't wake up celebrating the lack of bubonic plague either. But religion gets short shrift too. Little attention is paid to the complex layers of critical thinking that is involved in interpreting scriptures, or the problem-solving skills necessary to applying moral commands to everyday situation. Science requires awe just as religion requires intellectual exploration, but we only allow certain emotions for certain subjects. Science is allotted discipline, technical thought, while religion is granted passion. We have relegated our mental skills to their respective corners, and as a result, we ask baffling questions. Can you prove that God exists? Seems as unremarkable a formulation to us as, do you believe in science? But one shouldn't have to believe what can be known, and one shouldn't have to prove what is chosen for inspiration. Nevertheless, today's episode of Why is asking why people don't believe science. It will explore why people with incontrovertible evidence reject scientific conclusions, even when they themselves rely on them to do just about everything in their lives. We will start with the all-too-common premise that people simply don't know any better, but will discover that the answer is much more complex. Belief is political, sociological, and contextual. Knowledge, it turns out, is just as complicated. Maybe disbelief is religion's fault. Maybe faith has blinded believers and pushed aside reason. But maybe disbelief comes from science, which only accepts answers on its own terms, relegating metaphor to the dreaded teaching tool, or worse, to literature. Or maybe the problem is democracy and pluralism. Perhaps diversity and equality necessitate multiple answers in all areas of knowledge, not just the ones we choose for ourselves. The modern world likes to pretend that science is neutral and universal. It isn't. It is a contextual tool that we use and discard when convenient, just like religion, just like politics. Maybe then our question shouldn't be why people don't believe science, but when do they? Nothing can be all things to all people. Science's mistake is to think it can, but this is the same mistake religion makes. I'm not suggesting science is just a matter of faith. That would miss the point. I am suggesting, however, that the two aren't as far apart as we'd like to think. As complementary accounts of the true nature of the universe, they may simply be two sides of the same coin. And now our guest. Dan Kahan is the Elizabeth K. Dollard Professor of Law and Professor of Psychology at Yale Law School and a lead researcher for the Cultural Cognition Project. Dan, welcome to Why.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Jack.
We're live.
I feel smart already after that. That was very interesting set of opening remarks.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
I'm sure if the resurrection were broadcast, it would get very high ratings. But you know, the show that gets very high ratings, and much more higher than religious shows in the United States, is MythBusters. It's a show about these guys, basically, who do experiments. Are you hearing me?
I'm hearing you.
Okay, because there's a little bit of background noise. The two guys, and one says to the other, "Oh, what would happen if I dropped a penny off the Empire State Building? Would it go through somebody's skull?" And I goes, "Well, that's an interesting question. Well, I guess we can't do it, but..." And then he comes up with some kind of device, a gun that shoots the penny out of at just the right speed from the distance from the watermelon, which is situated so that it has the same kind of resistance as a human skull. And they figure it out. They're doing experiments, right? And people sit around and they want to watch that. So they go, "Oh, it's a show about people who are curious to figure out something." Right? And they're going to use this technique where they can't observe the thing they want to know, but they can observe other things from which they can infer it. And they think that's entertainment. They sit there and they watch it. People wouldn't know what the alternative to science's way of knowing was if it came up and whapped them in the face in the United States. There's no – science has won. And it has achieved what you said was the ambition – in your opening, that it failed to achieve. It got it. This is a pro-science society.
So let me just observe that while MythBusters is incredibly popular, so is The Walking Dead, a show about resurrection, although not the resurrection that we're talking to. And in and of itself, these two comments are going to rile people up. So let me remind everyone that we are live, that we'd love to hear the question and comments. They should email us at askwhy@und.edu. That's askwhy. They should post on our Facebook page at facebook.com/whyradioshow, tweet at whyradioshow, and join the conversation with our intern Darren in our chat room at whyradioshow.org. Now, you are already starting off by suggesting that the scientific viewpoint is inescapable. But at the same time, America, at least, Dan, is a nation of people who believe in angels, a nation of churchgoers and synagogue and mosque goers. And it's described as a religious nation. So are we entrepreneurs, technologically minded, science folk, or are we religious people who just like to unmask a good rumor like in MythBusters?
Jack, I actually missed a little bit of that because I'm having a little trouble here. Sometimes I'm missing parts of your audio. But The question about the contradiction or the tension between the status of the United States as a pro-science society and a religious society. Well, I mean, yeah, let's look at the premise. I mean, this is a fascinating question for me because the question is, why is this a question people ask? This society is about as pro-science as you could imagine. People go to church, they're going to follow the directions that their GPS system gives them. They don't think, oh, because Einstein, in his theory of relativity, guide this machine, it doesn't work. They take the antibiotics that their doctor gives them. They get the vaccinations. There's no correlation at all between whether people say they believe in evolution and whether they think vaccinations are great. And in fact, 9%, we've had 90% vaccination rates, the public health standard, for well over a decade. We don't really have meaningful part of our public that's anti-vaccination. Now, we have these people who are very religious. They apparently still are able to live in a way that treats science's way of knowing as authoritative. So you might think that's somehow evidence that there isn't this great tension. But in a sense, we don't have the religion that traditionally was what religion was. We don't cut people's heads off in the United States if we don't agree with their religious principles. Right? We're not like Afghanistan, where if a girl wants to go to school, you cut her nose off. Right? The kind of religious sensibilities we have been so domesticated by liberal institutions. They're there, and they're a meaningful part of people's lives. But they don't cause the kind of tension either between people and deciding on how to live or the kind of obstacle to science's way of knowing that it does in parts of the world where people still treat religion's way of knowing as authoritative. So the question to me is why? Why do we obsess with this question? How come we have this tension about science in our society? What exactly are they talking about?
Well, let me interrupt for just a second. Ask though if it's as marginalized as you suggest, and I can understand the argument that it is. Why is my Facebook feed filled with complaints about climate change, pro-life positions?
Yeah,
where does that come from? Who are those people?
I mean, I don't deny that the climate denier. I don't like the term denier, but I know, of course, there's conflict about climate change. And I know 50% of the United States approximately say they don't believe in evolution. But the question is, what is that exactly? Does that mean? Let's take evolution. There's zero correlation. I mean, literally zero between saying you believe in evolution and being able to give an account of the modern synthesis, natural selection, genetic variance and random mutation that would help you pass a high school biology exam. Right? The people who say they believe in evolution, very unlikely to know what that means. They think a giraffe was hungry for coconut. It stretched its neck up and the baby's neck was a little bit longer and it stretched its neck. They don't know what they believe. Right? The people who say they don't believe are just as likely to actually understand the modern synthesis. And you can teach people who say they don't believe evolution the modern synthesis just as readily as you can teach people who say they don't believe it. Afterwards, they won't say that they believe it, but they will, in fact, know it. And if they have any occasion to use it, which is unlikely because most of us have no occasion to use knowledge about evolution, but if they should become a doctor or a scientist, they can use it and will, even though they say they don't believe in it. Whereas the person who doesn't use it, if the person did manage to pass that high school exam, if he or she goes on to be a lawyer or an accountant, will forget the modern synthesis and still say he or she believes in evolution. This idea of believing evolution has very little to do with anything relating to the evidence about the natural history of human beings. It has everything to do with conveying that you're a certain kind of person in a society that, and this is the puzzling part, has decided it wants to make what looks like a question of empirical fact a kind of a marker of a tribal identity.
I want to hold off on the tribal identity part because it's incredibly interesting and I think we'll need to unpack it. But I want to call attention to something that you've said now a couple times because it's so fascinating. There is no correlation between believing in something and knowing about something. So I know a fair amount about Christianity because I'm a philosopher, because I teach undergraduates, because I find it interesting, but I am not a Christian. And what you're suggesting is that the same is true about evolution, about climate change, about vaccinations, that in fact, there's no connection between what we choose to believe in and what information we have or what we're even interested in knowing.
See, I don't know that maybe you'll get me to make a claim that strong.
Okay.
But I'm going to start out with a claim that's a lot less strong.
Okay.
That on certain issues that admit of scientific proof, people's beliefs are indicators of an identity. It have nothing to do with what they know about the evidence relating to that question. And in fact, people have to accept as known by science much, much more than they could possibly understand for themselves. I mean, there's just too much out there. You learn to recognize who knows what about what, right? So already, you're relying on some kind of indicator of authority or trust. Right? Now, on these issues where people disagree, I mean, they're not disagreeing because they don't know as much about as they do on the other issues, right? They don't know anything more about pasteurization of milk than they do about climate change, but they don't have the controversy about drinking raw milk in the United States, right? So the controversies on these issues aren't about what people know, right? But I'm not sure if the question in general, how knowledge and belief are connected, I think is more complicated. But on those issues, we're confusing something that is in fact just a kind of expression of identity for some kind of engagement with evidence about how the world works.
So what you're leading up to is something that in your work you refer to as refuting the public rationality thesis and replacing it with the cultural cognition thesis. The public irrationality thesis is this notion that people don't believe in science because they don't understand science. And if only we gave them good science education, if only we forced them to really understand science, they would then believe. It's their ignorance that makes them reject these hot button topics, but you say that's wrong. You say that's not really what's going
on. And I think that's wrong based on evidence. And I think that how people come to know what's known by science is an issue that admits of scientific investigation and in fact demands it, because you can see the kind of problems we have if we don't kind of attend to those processes and prevent them from becoming disrupted on these kinds of issues. Here's a hypothesis. The reason we have the conflict that we do over climate change has something to do with the public's inability to understand the evidence. I mean, the evidence is complicated, and most people don't know a lot of science, and so maybe they can be misled. People don't think the way scientists do. This is the argument in a kind of dispassionate, logical way. They go with their gut, and the prospect of the terrorist attacking the World Trade Center is so much more spectacular. People will obsess about that and ignore the more remote, but possibly more dangerous risks like the climate change. Now, if that's true, you should be able to present evidence of it. So my colleagues and I just wanted to investigate this. And in addition to figuring out, asking people what their beliefs were about climate change, we measured their science literacy using the standard measures of that the National Science Foundation puts out. We also measured their critical reasoning proficiencies with scales like the numeracy scale, which measures how well you can reason with quantitative information, and very important for thinking the way that a scientist does. And what we found is that there was, if you looked at the population, there was zero correlation between those kinds of measures of science comprehension and what people said they believed about climate change. But that was a little bit misleading, because the thing that did explain the division, people's cultural identities, actually did interact with their science comprehension. And science comprehension matters, but how it matters depends on who you are. So if you're the person who had the kind of cultural identity that was associated with believing in climate change, then the higher you scored on all these measures of science comprehension, the more likely you were to say you believed it. But if you were somebody who had the kind of cultural identity that's associated with being skeptical, then the higher you scored on all these measures, the less likely you were to say that you believed it. Right? That's not the kind of pattern you'd predict if your theory was the reason we have conflict over climate science is that people aren't doing well enough in science. Right? Obviously, the people who are the most science comprehending, they're not converging. Right? They're the most polarized. So we need another hypothesis.
So you're using the phrase cultural identity, but what you're referring to is the subgroups that people see themselves as. So rather than this being a question of knowledge of science, this may be a question of whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, whether you see yourself as a conservative Christian, whether you're a Baptist, whether you're a Hindu, whether you're a secular alternative kid from some suburb who wants to be punk, right? A Red Sox fan or something like that. I don't think the Cubs fans believe in science at all. I think they just want miracles. But
this is like this because, you know, the Red Sox and the Yankees, you know, a 1978 playoff game, right? Bucky Dent's home run.
Yes.
That was foul, okay? I'm telling you that. I know it was foul. Because here's the phenomenon of motivated reasoning. And the classic study is called They Saw a Game. And they it's done with a group of university students from two colleges. And they have them watch a tape of the football game between their school the last weekend. And they said, well, the referee made some controversial calls. And we want you to see if you think he got it right or wrong. And so all the students from it wasn't North Dakota University, it was some other Eastern university said, oh, the referee must have been in the pocket of Penn or something like that, said the Dartmouth students. And the Penn students say, oh, what is it? It must be a Dartmouth alum. This is motivated reasoning, this tendency to fit evidence of all kinds, including what you take in with your own senses, to some interest or goal you have that's independent of just figuring out what the right answer is. There, the goal was to experience this sense of connection to the other people who were fans of that team. And it was actually participating in conscripting their sense perceptions, and they would see this. Now, this is the same dynamic, I want to suggest, that's at work in these conflicts that we have about climate change and evolution. It's not at work in many times more issues, which is very important. But you see that the thing that's at issue is people have a big stake in connecting with their group. The same way it wouldn't be very good for you if you turned around in the stands and said, no, our guy really was out of bounds, everybody. Maybe next year we'll do better. Your life as a fan wouldn't go very well. If I leave this studio and I'm marching around with a sign that says climate change is a hoax, even with tenure, my life here in New Haven wouldn't be so good. Right? These kinds of issues become markers of identity, right? And you made a good point about you said I should be clear about what that is. But I'm going to pause right now, and you might want to ask another question.
It's a good time to pause because we have to take a break. When we come back from the break, we'll look at this notion of perspective and what team you're on, how it changes your notion. If you want to participate in the conversation, email us at asky@und.edu. Visit us at facebook.com/yradioshow. Tweet at yradioshow. And, of course, join us in our chat room at yradioshow.org. You're listening to Dan Kahan and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We'll be back right after this.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
You're back with Jack Russell Weinstein and Dan Kahan. We're asking the question, why don't people believe in science? You're listening to Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. You know, I was fiddling around the internet in the last couple of days, and I came across a video that has repeated an image that's been going around for a while now. And it's a photo of Steven Spielberg sitting in front of a dead dinosaur. And they show people the dinosaur and they ask, you know, well, what do you think of this? And they're horrified. They think it's a rhino. Some of them, others think it's a dinosaur. But even the ones who know it's a dinosaur are upset that he hunts. And it clearly was revived after this whole Cecil the Lion thing, where people were very upset about the American dentist going and shooting a lion and then doing stuff with it. And it is supposed to show that people don't know anything, that they can't figure out that it's a hoax, they can't figure out that it's special effects. But of course, what it reveals is whether or not you're a science fiction fan. It reveals whether or not you're willing to talk to a camera and make a fool of yourself. It reveals whether you're anti-hunting or pro-hunting. It reveals a whole host of yourself, information about you sociologically and psychologically, even if the only thing it may or may not reveal is, can you identify a Triceratops? And so I guess, Dan, the question I want to ask
just to be clear, it wasn't really a dead. He hadn't really killed a dinosaur.
No, right. It was.
I was starting to upset.
No, I understand. If there was a dinosaur and it was killed, that would be upsetting, you know, because we have at least one. But does the man in the street thing, or I should say the person in the street thing these days, does the person in the street interview when people don't know why we're celebrating July 4th or can't identify a science fiction animal or can't explain climate change, does that really give us any information about what people know and don't know?
Well, I mean, it kind of does, but it might be revealing that we don't know what it is that people need to know in order to get the benefits of what's known by science. One of the questions on the National Science Foundation science literacy test is antibiotics kill bacteria and viruses, true or false? and about 50% say it's true. They think it kills viruses. That's better than other countries, actually. But, you know, it doesn't matter. You don't have to get a medical degree to get the benefit of medical science. What you need to know is you go to the doctor when you're sick and you take the erythromycin when she prescribes it. And it would be a waste of your time to actually try to figure out why what she knows is what she knows. You should be using your time to figure out, well, who knows what about what? And people are extremely good at that. I mean, think about the amount of information that they're aligning themselves with properly without having to understand all of it. That actually is human reason, right? I mean, you wouldn't know it. We wouldn't know very much, right? If each one of us had to reinvent everything that's known on his or her own. It's only because we have this kind of division of intellectual labor that we're able to do this. So I think that those kinds of questions usually have a mistaken premise, that somehow whether people know the answer to that is a measure of whether they know anything.
Before the break, you suggested that belief in science is in some sense analogous to sports loyalty, that if you are in a certain subgroup or you share a certain cultural identity, you are going to feel the pressure to either believe in climate change or evolution or vaccinations or not believe in these things. And one of the examples you give – well, let me ask you to talk a little bit more about that, and then I'm going to ask you about the Pakistani doctor, because he's the example you use to suggest that what you're talking about isn't really a contradiction at all. But why don't you explain a little bit about how social identity works in this
world? This is actually – it brings us back to some of the themes you were raising earlier, right? So I said that this dynamic where people become polarized on these facts that admit of scientific investigation is akin to the kind of conflict you see between the fans of the rival sports teams that have an identity with those sports teams, with the other fans. We want to know, do people – it's not a sign of people not knowing things. Right? In a sense, the disagreement is that people are too rational at giving effect to the information that helps to connect them with the groups that they belong to. Right? I mean, a person who makes a mistake about climate change, it doesn't have any effect on climate change. Right? What you believe about climate change doesn't affect the climate. You don't matter enough as an individual, your carbon consumption – to have an impact, or as a voter or somebody making an argument to change policy. But given what the issue has now come to signify within these kinds of groups, you make a mistake about that, and it could have huge consequences for you. And you don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand these things. I mean, it's like knowing that you should cover your mouth when you cough or something like that, social competence. But if you are really good at manipulating data and making logical arguments, well, you can use that kind of intelligence to do an even better job at forming and persisting in the beliefs that will convey to other people whose good opinion you depend on psychically and materially for your well-being that you have those beliefs. Right? The problem is people are – it's not that they're not rational. It's that they're being too rational. Right? Or it's not stupid people. It's a polluted science communication environment. It's stupid that there's something – what is it that's made these kinds of facts come to have that significance? Because that's not true, right, about cell phone radiation. That's not true about the magnetic waves from the power lines. That's not true about fluoride in the water. You know, it's not true about orders of magnitude more things where these people are converging. So that's the way to understand this, I think, that there's a kind of a pollution in the science communication environment, these meanings that attach to the facts and make them into badges of identity, at which point it's perfectly rational for the individual to use his or her reasoning to form those positions that will connect them to the group, even though if everybody does that at once, everybody will be worse off because then we're not going to converge on the best evidence as a society. But that doesn't change the situation for you. Right? So I think that's what we should be trying to understand. What are those processes that cause that?
So let's take an extreme example. Let's look at the last election when President Obama was running for re-election, and there was a large field of Republican candidates for the primary, although not as large as right now. There was a famous moment during the debate when the candidates were asked, how many of you believe in evolution, or how many of you, I think, don't believe in evolution? And all of them raised their hand except one. Now, the general interpretation, certainly amongst Democrats and liberals, was that, oh, look at how stupid or look at how irrational these candidates were. But what you're saying is, no, in fact, these candidates are incredibly irrational because they weren't actually answering the question, do you know about evolution and do you believe in it? They were asking, do you want to be identified as a Republican? They felt, perhaps rightly, that they could not win the Republican nomination if they believed in evolution. So they were, in essence, answering a different question, or at least, to take it more extreme, they have to not believe in evolution because they have to see themselves as a Republican and they want everyone else to. Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, yeah, although I think that I don't mean to – I'm trying to give an account of how ordinary people come to know what's known and right. Why we see these kinds of conflicts between ordinary members of society. Politicians – I don't think it generalizes necessarily to politicians. They're professionals using professional judgment. And the thing that they're best at is counting to 51%. And so I think the best answer is always going to be they're going to say what they think will get them elected. Now, then the question becomes, I mean, and as you alluded to, well, why do they think they have to say that? They're right to believe they have to say that. Right? They're right to believe that they have to take a position on climate change that matches the identity of the constituencies they're depending on to be elected, because otherwise – they'll be turned out as people who basically are seen as traitors, who don't have the right kinds of values. How did that happen is what I'm saying is the important question to ask. But we might, you know, if we try to think about what it's like for the individual, right? I mean, I don't think the individual is like a politician on the stage saying, well, I'm going to represent that I have this belief about climate change. I mean, it happens much more unconsciously and naturally, right? I think through the very same processes that help them to understand what any evidence is on anything, right? They just listen to the people who are around them, who they think know what they're talking about.
So let's take a slightly different example, and I'll pick on the Democrats for a second. Democrats are largely against the Keystone Pipeline, yet I, for one, have no opinion on the matter, if I'm being honest. And if I were to self-identify as a Democrat and I walked into a room of Democrats, I would be worried that if I said something about the Keystone Pipeline, I'd get yelled at. I'd be ostracized. And that pressure is even made even more extreme if we're talking about family relationships or neighborhood relationships or religious relationships that form the foundation of our personal experience. And so really part of what you're suggesting is that scientific belief or adherence to a scientific claim is much more about social pressures and comfort and anxiety than it is about evaluating the facts in and of themselves. And you give a whole bunch of examples, and we'll start with the Pakistani doctor, of people who know the facts but choose to almost be have multiple personalities about those facts. Can you explain the Pakistani doctor and what that represents?
But to hold off, I will. Yeah. But to just hold off on that for the 1 second. I mean, let's not make the mistake, you know, it's a kind of bias, you know, kind of availability bias. You know, people don't stand by the highway watching all the cars that go by that don't crash. They come running if there's a car crash. Right? The number of issues that have this quality where people are polarized based on their identity, and the polarization gets even more intense as their science comprehension goes up, is tiny compared to the number of issues that aren't like that, that could be, where these people are converging. Right, so
we all believe in the internal combustion engine. We all believe that heat warms us up. We all believe that sun will give us sunburn. Right, these sorts of things,
and even things we don't even think about. You know, we just do it. We just live next to, you know, the reverse osmosis plant number 6 that treats our water and don't give it a second thought because we see other people like us living there. Now, what we do there is just use the best information we have about what's known. What do other people who know what they're doing, how are they aligning themselves with respect to this issue? And you do it. That's when you want to know what the best evidence is. I want to say, though, that what is happening when people form these positions on climate change, they're not trying to figure out what the best evidence is. No, I don't say that they're doing this consciously, but I want to say that it's akin to a different kind of mental operation. Think about this. You go into a restaurant and you tip the waiter or waitress. You know, if I went to the restaurant with you and saw you not tipping, that I would have a negative opinion of you. But I bet you do it even when you go out by yourself to do it. Well, why? Because you've just become the kind of person who knows that that's what you should do. That's just it's not a belief. It's just an attitude, a kind of disposition that you formed, no doubt in relation to social cues about what you should be doing if you're a good person, right? That's exactly the kind of orientation that somebody has to this question, evolution, right, or climate change. In most cases, they have nothing else to do with that belief besides be the kind of person who has a position on it, right? Now I can tell you about the Pakistani doctor because he has something else to do with it. I don't want to keep going too long, right? But here's the thing: this is somebody he featured in a brilliant study by a scholar named Salman Ameed, who goes to Islamic countries and he asks the science trained professionals, mainly doctors, how they deal with the tensions between religious tenets and their professional science knowledge. And so he's really wonderful. He has a kind of a script. He's saying to the doctor, so, you know, do you believe in evolution? And the Pakistani doctor says, no, I don't believe in evolution. We didn't descend from monkeys. You know, Allah created us. And okay. Next question I have here. I see you're an oncologist. Is that right? Yes. Do you ever use evolutionary science in your practice as an oncologist? And he goes, yes, of course I do. Sometimes I have to know what the indicators are, genetic indicators of cancer. And Salman Hamid, maybe the first time he was confused, but he just kind of, at this point he's playing a role. He's like, oh, okay. Well, the next question I have here is, do you think that evolutionary science is relevant to medical research? And the doctor goes, yeah, of course it is. Do you know anything about stem cells? I'll explain it to you. He thinks he's a moron at that point. You know, and then Salman goes, oh, okay, I understand. Oh, the next question I have here is, do you believe in evolution? And the Pakistani goes, you already asked me that question. I don't believe in evolution. You know, and then Salman says, well, I don't understand. You said you don't believe in it, and you do. And he says, you are very confused. Do you want to talk about my life as a doctor or my life as somebody who is a member of this community and what I do at home? And he goes, I'll make it simple for you. I believe it at work, but I don't believe it at home. Now, he's not saying I have a split personality or anything like this. What he's saying is, what does it mean to have a belief independently of what you do with it? He has a belief in evolution that's built into all the other kinds of mental routines he uses to be a doctor. That's suited for being a doctor. But he also has an orientation toward this issue of the meaning of life in his religious community that when he's in that setting, says, I don't believe in evolution. That's what he uses the disbelief for. How are they even, unless the things he's doing with these kinds of mental objects are inconsistent, why would we think they were the same thing? Right? That's what I think he understands, the Pakistani doctor. And ironically, we don't, right? Even though he has to contend, you know, with a lot more genuine religious opposition to scientific knowledge and tolerance of other people's lives than we do.
And this isn't exclusive to Pakistan, right? You talk about the Kentucky farmer who's a similar situation.
Climate change, because the most, I mean, if you're leaving partisanship aside, the segment of society that's the most climate skeptical are farmers. You ask them, you believe in climate change, you know, they say something I couldn't say about Al Gore, you know, no, of course not. Right? but you see, ask them when they're riding their tractor. They're the segment of society that uses climate science consciously, self-consciously, more than any other. They engage in farming practices like no-till farming. Why do they do it? Because they've been told that as a result of climate change, the soil is going to be exposed to conditions that will, like drought, that will make it less robust. And so no-till farming is actually a better way to preserve the fertility of the soil. They buy more crop failure insurance because they've been told there's going to be more variance because of climate change, right? Monsanto, you know, they're very excited because Monsanto is making genetically modified seeds that they can still grow the corn. I mean, they're actually planting soybeans now instead of corn because they've been told that with the climate change, the growing season is going to change, and they believe it. But Monsanto, in addition to making the new seeds, it also went out and bought a company called Climate Corporation, which was synthesizing all the best evidence from universities and government agencies, all the stuff that goes into the IPCC report on climate change, and presenting it in a form where it could be custom tailored to your farm, right? You can iPad application. It tells you, here's what's going to happen on your farm. And boy, does the farmer want that, right? Monsanto pays $1 billion for that because they know that farmer is hungry for scientific information and has always been using it. The Kentucky farmers, I call him the Kentucky farmer. He's like the Pakistani doctor. He's probably the Oklahoma farmer. Right? He's represented by Inhofe, the senator who brings the snowball into the Senate right. to show that there's snow outside and Gore must be an idiot. And I'm sure that the farmer gets a good laugh out of that. But he wouldn't be laughing if Inhofe wasn't also sponsoring the farm bill, which is going to send back tens of millions of dollars, literally. To Oklahoma universities to do research on climate change adaptation because he knows that's happening. Right? There's two climate changes. The one he believes in or disbelieves in order to be a certain kind of person, when essentially he's engaged in an activity that's akin to rooting for the Yankees or the Red Sox, and he knows which what his position is to do that. But then there's the climate change that he believes in because he's a farmer. And when he's a farmer, he uses his knowledge of what science knows to do that. Now, you know, that's a contradiction. I mean, I see the tension, right? But here's the point. The people who say they believe in climate change, they think things like, okay, carbon's a greenhouse gas, but carbon also kills plants in greenhouses, right? It interferes with photosynthesis. They don't really know anything about it. They just know they believe in it. They don't have any use for this information aside from being the kind of person who they are.
What's the solution? Is there a problem that needs to be solved? And what's the solution to get people to believe in science in their private lives when they believe in science in their professional lives? Or is it a non-issue when we just go about our business?
Well, but it's not any good, obviously, when some issue of consequence takes on this kind of character and gives people who obviously are competent at orienting themselves with respect to what's known by science some alternative incentive to orient themselves toward these issues that doesn't have anything to do with the truth. I mean, we should be trying to figure out how things like that happen and what we can do to prevent them from happening. Again, the number of issues that are like this are tiny in relation to the number of issues that are. And nothing has to be this way. These things happen because of some set of events, right? So we should be using scientific understandings to essentially protect the science communication environment from the kind of pollution, right? These meanings that become connected to the facts that then generate this kind of dispute. But this idea that we must have a segment in our society that hates science and can't reason and is stupid, that actually is a symptom of the very kind of disease we're talking about. It's not true, right? So it is part and parcel of that competition over things like climate change and evolution that we keep thinking the reason we have this problem is that, oh, those guys are anti-science or stupid.
So the name-calling and the attitudes and the senses of superiority, this is actually part and parcel of the same political landscape that prevents people from ascribing to the truth in the first place.
Sure. And here's a – you mentioned vaccines. Now, the truth is there's people wildly overstate how much resistance there is to vaccines in this country. There are people who are anti-vaccine, but they're outliers in any of these groups. Right? The same people who disagree about evolution, they overwhelmingly agree that you should have vaccines. Same people who disagree about climate change overwhelmingly agree you should have vaccines. Right? So we overstate this. But here's a kind of trope that you see in the internet, right? Oh, the anti-science virus. You know, it was kind of funny. You know, initially, the symptoms were the disbelief in evolution. But then, you know, a little bit more alarmingly, it mutated and people started to deny climate change. Well, now it's become so, you know, it's mutated in this horrible toxic form where people are denying that vaccines work. You know, this is the anti-science virus. Now, this is designed to kind of create this sense of contempt, right? Not only do these guys disagree with me about evolution and climate change, they don't even think vaccines work and are good. They must be very bad. Well, that's actually not true. But if you fill up the science communication environment with the message, oh, you know, this is another issue on which this group has this position and that group has another position, you might very well make it into that kind of issue. So exactly that kind of use of the anti-science kind of insult is a way that it risks pulling into this kind of problem. We have even more issues, scientific issues. Yeah, so people should refrain from doing that.
So taking a step back, what does this tell us about democracy, right? If there are these competing notions of commitment to science or belief in science or knowledge applies in some areas and not other areas, does that mean that democracy is inherently fragmented? Are we falling apart as a participatory government?
Well, You know, there's a bigger issue about polarization, and I accept it's clearly true that we have a lot more division right now than we've had in recent years. I don't know what the mean in standard deviation, though, is. You know, I can remember times, you know, after the Vietnam War where there's a lot of tension, too. But here's but I do think that this question about democracy and conflict over science is a really important one. You know, there's a deep congeniality between liberal democracy and science, right? And Karl, this was the theme Karl Popper stressed. It's not an accident that he wrote both the Logic of Scientific Discovery and the Open Society and Its Enemies. You can't have the kind of inquiry that drives scientific knowledge except in a liberal society, not just because the investigation by empirical means will get blocked by bureaucracy or interest. People won't develop the habits of mind, right, of questioning and challenging that are the essential kind of fuel, right, in the engine of scientific discovery, conjecture and refutation. And here, the same things that make a democracy so congenial to acquiring knowledge create a challenge for actually certifying what's known, right? Nobody can tell us what to believe. Right? The motto of the Royal Society, nullius in verba, you know, take nobody's word for it.
Right.
Which is kind of it's inspiring, but it's silly. You know, don't tell me what Newton said about, you know, gravity. I'm going to figure this out for myself. Or don't tell me about relativity. I'm going to point my own telescope at the sun and figure that. Well, you know, if you're that smart in 500 years, you'll have figured out, you know, what we know right now, but you'll be 500 years behind. You should not take the word of anybody whose knowledge isn't based on science's way of knowing, which is observation, right, and valid inference from what we can observe in the facts, not through authority. But here's the problem. Nobody can tell you what it is that science knows. That's built into science. It's built into liberal democracies. Well, we have to trust the people who we know what's known by science, but the people we know, people we trust, they're going to be people who have our kinds of cultural commitments. It can't be any authority figure. The number of certifiers is going to be multiplying at the same time that the knowledge is increasing. And there's bound just by just sheer probability to be these occasions in which the groups that have this function of certifying what's known to their members, right, will come into disagreement. And at that point, you can have this kind of conflict. I don't think that's an inherent contradiction. I just think that's a problem to be solved, you know, by scientific means. So I think there is a connection between the kind of science communication problem we're talking about and democracy. But it's the kind that you can have only because democracy is itself so suited for scientific inquiry because of its pluralism.
How good are people at determining who is a reputable authority and who isn't? I mean, our television commercials are full of sports figures telling us all these things, but we don't necessarily. I in my head, one of my favorite sports stories is I think it's the first Bush election, and Charles Barkley, the basketball player who many of our younger listeners will not know who he is, but Charles Barkley is being interviewed, and he says, "I used to hate George Bush because I thought he only cared about rich people, but then I thought, hey, wait a minute, I'm rich." And then he got a talk show out of it, right? Uh-huh. How good are we at picking authorities?
Well, I mean, we're obviously good at figuring out what's known by science. Right? To live, period, much less to live well, you have to avail yourself of the collective knowledge we have. And it's way more, as I said earlier, than any one of us is in a position, even a scientist, to figure out for him or herself. So we have to become an expert at knowing who knows what about what. And people do a really good job at that. They can do the child development psychology will show you that they start to recognize, pick up right away, who are the experts? And usually they're not disagreeing. When there's some kind of an issue, though, where the positions become these badges of identity, At that point, they're going to start to conform their understanding of who really is an expert to what their positions are on those issues, right? But at that point, you've got a pathology on your hands. I mean, that's something that's unusual and bad. But in general, they're very good at it, right? You talked earlier about you go on the internet, you can find all kinds of crazy things that are said. Well, very few of them are believed by people, right? How are they figuring out not to believe all of the garbage that's on the internet? Right? There is just as much about chemtrails as there is about climate change. There aren't nearly as many people who think chemtrails are poisoning us because the CIA is think that climate change. How do they figure out how to reject that? Right? There's the being able to pick up the signal of what science knows through all the noise. You know, that takes a certain kind of reason. Right? It's obvious people are very good at that.
You seem much more optimistic about people's abilities than I would have thought you would have been, especially when I first encountered your research when mm-hmm. when I invited you onto the show. You have a lot of faith in people's intellects and their ability to see through the noise. So what's happening in people's private lives when they reject evolution or climate change? Is this a form of self-deception?
Well, I think what's happening is that the same kind of faculties that people normally use reliably to figure out what's going on are now giving them feedback that misleads them because they're exercising those faculties essentially in a polluted science communication environment, right? Where the kinds of cues that they normally rely on and that bring these groups into convergence now are driving them apart. Right? They figure out what's known inside of these affinity groups, which are filled with people who know what's known by science and they're good at transmitting it. I mean, if you had a group out there that was consistently misleading its members about what was known by science, it wouldn't last very long, right? And you can figure that out even if you don't believe in evolution, because it would be a selection problem there. But when these kinds of issues become suffused with these meanings, then you have this kind of problem. The key is to figure out how does something like that happen? How do you avoid it? Right? And that's something that requires scientific knowledge too. Right? We should be using our reason to protect the conditions on which our reason depends. And I think that's something that people across all these groups, if they're not thinking about a particular issue on which they're polarized, will agree that that's something that ought to be done. Everybody knows that these kinds of influences can mislead them. They all know they have an interest in having a communication environment that's free of them.
You've used the phrase polluted science environment several times. What does that mean, and what does a non-polluted, a pure science, what is a good communication environment?
I'll just use it. Of course, you know, these are models.
Well, sure,
they're
of
like
course.
Bohr, Rutherford, Atom or something. But here's a way to think about it. Here's the question. How do people align themselves with what's known by science? It can't be, nullius in verba. Like, I'll figure it out for myself with my own experiments. There's too much to be known. They become experts at knowing who knows what about what. The science communication environment is just the sum total of influences and processes and cues that people normally consult to good effect to align themselves with the best information that's important for their decision-making, individual and collective. The place where they tend to do that are in these groups, right? I mean, your kid gets a puffy face and it's turning blue and it smells bad. You know, a scientist doesn't come to your house and explain gangrene. Your neighbor says, get that kid to the emergency room. Don't just give him aspirin or something like this. You're surrounded with all these people giving you this information and you're good at picking up on it. Well, normally, I mean, as insular as that might be, it leads these groups, these different diverse cultural groups, to the same answer. Right? It doesn't only win positions on some issue that admits of scientific investigation becomes entangled in these symbols that make them into kind of badges of identity and loyalty in these groups. At that point, people will have a stake in using their reason to connect themselves to the group that's at odds with the stake they have in figuring out the right answer. That's the pollution in the science communication environment.
Trying to formulate this question, Following Popper and following John Stuart Mill, who in some sense anticipated Popper, would we be better off, would we be more scientifically sophisticated if we weren't creating these enclaves of similarity on our social networks or lived amongst different people? We've had a couple different neighbors in the house next door to us, and we've been friends with all of them, but all of those neighbors have fundamentally different political points of view than we do and fundamentally different religious points of view than we do. Are we better off and more scientifically literate because we encounter this difference, or does proximity is whatever's going on deeper or bigger than proximity?
Well, you know, there are just as many the groups are just as likely to be wrong as right when this kind of thing happens. If their group happens to have the view that's in line with scientific consensus, they're just lucky, right? So I don't think there's one group out there that does better than all the others in figuring out what's known by science. So I don't think you'd be any better off without one of the groups. I think clearly you are better off when you have diversity. Here's a concrete context where this kind of dynamic plays out. If you're running a business and you have to have a dynamic problem-solving environment, there are two kinds of considerations, or there are two kinds of problem situations you should think of. If you need to have an answer right away, right, then you should be putting people who are relatively like each other together because they understand each other better. They're not going to fight with each other. They're kind of good at reading each other, right? They're going to be able to know who knows what within that group more reliably than one that's filled with diverse people. But if you have a problem that's long-term, you want to have those diverse people together because they'll learn through their interactions who knows what about what and create for themselves the kind of natural cues that they were otherwise relying on when they were with people like them to understand who knows what about what. And they will know more because they're going to be more diverse, right? Now, that's me as a business manager putting those people together. You're out in society. You're going to hang out with your friends. That's the easiest way for you to get the information. So naturally, that's going to happen, but it probably isn't. It probably does constrain to some extent the proliferation of knowledge, except that, you know, obviously, even though you're at differences with your neighbors, I assume they're not trying to kill you or anything like that.
Not yet.
I mean, they might be able to sell you something. Well, look, why? This is what we understand in the United States. Don't cut his head off. You might be able to sell him something, right? And so you're going to find an opportunity for interactions where actually you can get the knowledge, because it's not going to be any experience that believing what that guy says is contrary to your group's identity.
Is this phenomenon limited to science? And I have in mind, I am recalling that you are a law professor. And I know that there is tremendous debate about what the Second Amendment means. Means that whether there's a right to privacy, what kind of speech should or shouldn't be protected. Is there a similar phenomenon in legal reasoning and in casework that you're describing in science?
That's interesting. Yeah, sure. A lot of these dynamics play out in legal settings. In legal settings, for one thing, people have to make judgments about facts on the basis of evidence. And the same way you could have the kind of motivated reasoning that's dividing people who are on different teams and they saw a game, you could have that in a legal setting. We did a study. We called it They Saw a Protest. And what we did was we showed the videos of protesters, and we told the subjects in the study, imagine you're on the jury and you have to decide, did these people engage in intimidation? Were they going to be violent? That's what the police said, or were their First Amendment rights violated because people didn't like what they were saying and the police interfered with them, even though they were just engaged in peaceful protesting? We told half the people that the protesters were anti-abortion demonstrators at an abortion clinic, and the other half that they were protesters who were against the exclusion of gays and lesbians from the military. Again, the audience might be too young to remember this. We used to exclude openly gay men and women from the military. And so they were protesting against Don't Ask, Don't Tell at the military recruitment center. Then we saw that people who had different cultural outlooks, who thought they were watching the same protest, they would disagree with each other about whether somebody just hit somebody over the head with a sign, right, or was blocking the door to a building. But those same people were disagreeing with people who had the same values, but who thought they were watching a different kind of video, right? Those kinds of facts bear a certain kind of significance in the lives of people. They determine whose side you're on. So that can easily prevent the law not only from achieving the kind of accuracy that it wants to on facts, but also the kind of neutrality it should have in a liberal society between people who have different outlooks and cultural identities.
So what do the last question, what do we walk away with from this? I mean, there's a lot of optimism in people's capabilities. There's a lot of pessimism. What do we want our listeners to take away? Obviously, people aren't as dumb as you think they are, and belief
in
science.
What they should take away, though, is that there's something you can do about it. And I keep saying we should figure this out. And you know, how do things become this way? And we should do something. And I haven't been concrete enough about that. But you remember the HPV vaccine controversy, I'm sure,
right,
just a few years ago.
I have a daughter, so it's
okay.
It's particularly
relevant. So we have a country that there's only one state, Virginia, that has adopted the mandatory vaccination, which is what the CDC says you should have for teenage boys and girls at this point. Right. The reason they adopted it is because Merck, the company that makes the drugs, gave them a lot of money to open a plant there. But we were having political controversy about this. And you might think, well, you know, it's obvious we're going to have it because, you know, somebody's knocking on your door saying, hey, you know, your daughter, the one, the 12-year-old in the swing out there, it's the one who's going to be having sex next year. Yeah, she has to get an STD shot, you know, a venereal disease shot, in case you don't know what that is. Otherwise, don't bring her to school. Now, of course, there's going to be conflict over that. But at the very time that we're having this controversy, we have the HBV vaccine, which is the hepatitis B vaccine. And hepatitis B is a sexually transmitted disease. The CDC said it should be given to all children. At the very time that we were fighting about the HPV vaccine, almost every state put it onto its schedule of mandatory vaccinations, and the vaccination rate was 95%. And at that time, it was being given to middle school kids. Now it's for infants. But there was a catch-up period at that time. Why were the two different? Well, people learned about the HPV vaccine from Fox News, from MSNBC. It was introduced to them as a political controversial issue because of decisions that were made by the manufacturer to try to get legislative mandates through before its competitor could enter the market. Normally, the public health administrators are not political. They've been assigned the task to figure out what should be on the vaccination list. Everybody agrees there should be mandatory vaccinations, and they just do what the CDC says. They did that with the HBV vaccine. And you learned about it instead from your doctor, who you picked because you're an expert at figuring out who knows what about what. And that person told you, well, you know, I'm gonna jab Jane or Johnny with the HBV vaccine. I don't care. We're away to soccer practice. Just hurry up, you know. And you found out about it under the conditions that enable you to make a judgment about whether this is something that science knows, right? If I tell a parent, I tell you, because we did an experiment like this, you know, that if I can simulate conditions where you learn about the HPV vaccine and whether you think it's dangerous for your daughter or healthy for your daughter, it'll depend. You'll be judging this in the same way that the sports fan, right, that I did about whether Bucky having Dent's home run was fair or foul, you wouldn't think that was funny. You'd be horrified. You don't want to think that when you're deciding whether something's good for your daughter, that you're essentially being like a sports fan making a foul ball call. You don't want that to be an environment in which that's what you're doing, deciding whose team you're on. You want that to be an environment in which you're using information that's essential to the well-being of your family. And it could have been that way for the HPV vaccine. People knew this could happen. They said it at the time. We did studies that simulated these conditions and showed it could happen. And it wasn't as if people said, oh, you know, we disagree. Who are we talking to? Nobody. There's no agency. There's no science communication environment protection agency. It's not the FDA's job to worry about this. It's not the AMA, American Medical Association, doesn't worry about this. We don't have the institutions and practices that would allow us to use the knowledge we have about how people come to know what's known to protect what we all have a stake in, which is a science communication environment where we won't be misled.
That is an intriguing idea to think about a science communication agency. And I wonder, and we don't have time for this, but I wonder, would it be possible to have a depoliticized science communication agency when we don't even have a depoliticized school system, right? I mean, one would think that the science teachers would be a place to learn the good science without looking for a fight, which is what you get when you hear from MSNBC or Fox News. But we're at a time where school is incredibly politicized, and maybe this is why. Maybe this is why, so that all of these groups can continue to have their partisan battles in the classroom. I don't know. It's a really interesting place to be. But to the fact that we have to take science communication more seriously and depoliticize it and disentangle it from this identity politics, I think that's an incredibly important message. Dan, thank you so much for joining us on Why.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll be back right after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Why Radio Store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
We're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We've been talking about science and why people believe in science. And of course, we've been challenging the notion that people don't believe in science at all. We've been asked to reframe the question. You know, Plato's classical critique of democracy is that it was ruled by the ignorant. He saw democracy as a disastrous experiment of governance by people who didn't know any better. And ever since then, politics has been about telling other people that they are ignorant. It's about seeing your opposition as not knowing any better. The essence of this conversation is that that's simply not true. People are a lot smarter than we think they are, and they're a lot smarter than we want to claim they are when we disagree with them. They have scientific knowledge when they need it, not when it is convenient or not when it is convenient for us. They have scientific knowledge when it is useful for them. The same person can believe in climate change when he or she is in the harvest and not believe in climate change when he or she is engaged in religious worship or what have you. That's an incredibly interesting and complicated notion of what it means to be a human being. It also means that scientific knowledge is a political problem. And like all political problems, the central debate is going to be, is the solution from the people or is the solution from the government? Dan suggested that we imagine an agency interested and focused on scientific communication. Is that a good solution? I don't know, but it's interesting and it's worth thinking about. It wouldn't be the National Education Association. It wouldn't be the same people who pick our teachers. It would be the people who are interested in communicating truth. But that, of course, leads to the same question, whose truth? And that, as always, is the place where philosophy starts. Whose truth? You've been listening to Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. As always, it's an honor to be with you.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua y Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/Mark Weinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.